I want to call this meeting of the House Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee to order for Thursday, March 30th, 2017. So we still have one member missing, so I think I will open the hearing. We'll reverse the order, and I'll open the hearing on House Bill 3106. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 3106. And Zena, if you would read the information, please.
Chair Lively and members of the committee, House Bill 3106 modifies the family income requirements for participation in a preschool program administered by the Early Learning Division. There is a -3 amendment which replaces the measure. It requires the early learning hubs to convene Oregon pre-kindergarten programs and preschool programs to coordinate enrollment of eligible children and to determine programs that best meet the needs of children. It requires the Early Learning Council to create plans for changes to the Head Start program. It directs the Early Learning Council to adopt rules to provide half-day, full-day, or combined Oregon pre-kindergarten programs based on community needs assessments. There is a minimal fiscal impact, but no statement is issued, and there's no revenue impact.
Okay. So, we have a list. Okay. So, on the list we have Donna Schnitker, Dana Hepner, and David Mandel, and then Eva is on the three chairs, so. Okay. No, I've only couldn't call you once, that's it, so you're done.
Oh. You would.
Wow.
She'll come up anyway, won't she?
Four session only.
Welcome, and please state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you. Representative Chair Lively and members of the committee, my name is Donna Schnitker, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Head Start Association. But in my real life, I am a Head Start director in Harney County. So today, I am here in support of House Bill 3106-3, and mostly because we started out with an amendment that talked about convening the Head Start program and the preschool promise programs together, the hub being the convener. We also want to say that our intention was for all early learning providers in the hub area to come together and talk about the enrollment issue. There were a few problems this year, and this just sort of formalizes the requirement of everybody getting together and talking about service areas and where the families are, and also being very respectful of the families themselves and what their wishes are, but working out the issues at a very local level. The second part of the amendment talks about allowing the Oregon pre-kindergarten program to extend their days. On November 7th of last year, Head Start issued new performance standards. The key change in those performance standards was requiring Head Start programs to eventually extend to 6-hour days and 1,096 hours per year. So it's really not full day and full year, it's just they call it extended year. So in statute it says that Oregon pre-kindergarten program would follow the federal guidelines, and in order to do that we need to make some changes. And if we make this amendment, it allows the Early Learning Division to come up with some rules on how programs who have families who really need the 6 hours of service or longer have the option of being able to do that where they don't right now. And so it's really actually meeting the needs of the programs and the families at a local level, and also making us compliant in Oregon with the federal performance standards. And the bill also makes it possible so that you don't necessarily have to convert to the extended day. You have options of part day. You can have an option of extending your day or doing a combination of both. And I think it's very beneficial. I hear Head Start directors saying right now that they have families who need longer days. And now we don't have that option. But with this amendment, it would make it possible to do that.
Very good. Thank you.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Director of Policy and Program at the Children's Institute, and we're also here in support of House Bill 3106-3 amendments. Donna did a great job of explaining what the amendment does. We think it's very appropriate to statutorily clarify that the hub should be in the role of convening and coordinating with preschool providers in their region, just as they are with so many other types of providers in their regions. That is just completely aligned with the intent of the hubs when they were created. And also agree with the increased flexibility for use of OPK dollars. The quick clarifications on the, kind of the intentions of the stakeholders who've been around the conversation to create this amendment that we want to add to the record are, one, we all agree that parent choice should be maintained in the selection of a preschool program for children and families. And so I think the language, you know, says that the providers will get together and discuss a kind of a most appropriate fit for a family, especially a family who may qualify for Head Start or Preschool Promise, for example, and just clarifying that a piece of that conversation will be the parent, what the parent says that they want, and they'll stay in the role of being the decider about their destiny. And also just that enrollment coordination may look very different by region. So when the hubs convene folks in Multnomah County, and have to coordinate, okay, who's going to recruit families in which neighborhoods and which school catchment areas and figure out all that stuff. It could look very different in, you know, one place where we work in Yoncalla, Oregon, where it's pretty easy to say, all right, anyone who lives in Yoncalla, we take. Anyone who lives in Sutherland Head Start, you take. And so it'll just, the level of ongoing coordination needed will vary depending on the unique circumstances of any hub.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Chair Lively, committee members, for the record, I'm David Mandel, Acting Early Learning System Director. Thanks for having me back. I just want to talk a little bit about the parts of the bill around the full day and part-day programs, although I think Donna actually covered the issue really well. As we've talked to this committee about before, Oregon actually has a really unique collaboration with the federal Head Start program through Oregon Pre-Kindergarten. And as Donna also mentioned, when that program was created in 1988, basically put in statute that OPK will follow the federal Head Start performances and follow both means that will be the guiding. And as those changes happened at the federal level, they also become changes in Oregon. This has really meant some great collaboration has been possible at the, you know, at the program and classroom level. Most of our OPK programs are also receiving federal Head Start dollars, all but seven. And so what that means is at the classroom level, there's also the ability to completely blend and braid, actually completely blend funding at the classroom level. But as the federal program moves to a full-day program, full-day funding, we're going to need to figure out what that means. The federal government has already given extension grants to a couple programs in Oregon to allow them to have extra funding to have a full-day program. So that's going to create some complications if we're still funding that the rest of the kids in that classroom at the half-day funding level. So we're going to have to figure out how to do that. And then, as was also mentioned, in some communities, there may be a real interest and desire for our parents to still have that part-day option. So we also just want to give programs the security that if there is a complete move on the federal level to full-day programs, if a program is able to have a classroom or two, that it can fund through state dollars to have that flexibility if that's where the real community needs it.
Very good. Any questions for this panel? Okay, doesn't look like it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Donna, for driving so far for this. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Eva Repito, please. Thank you for being so patient.
Sure. Eva Repito, Oregon AFSCME Council 75. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to weigh in. We're supportive. We represent, as you know, child care providers who are some preschool promise providers, and then we also have Head Starts in a couple places around the state. The only red flag in the deck of threes was, I think, addressed, was that it was OPK programs and ELDs coming to the meeting, but I understand that that the invitation will be broader, and that was my only little concern that I had. So as long as I know that others will be invited, I'm fine.
You're okay.
Great, thank you.
Great, thank you. Okay, anybody else? Doesn't look like it. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3106, And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3106. And so, members, so first we need to adopt the Dash 3 amendments, which essentially replaces the bill. So who's going to?
So we're opening a work session on 3106.
Yep, I have the work.
Chair Lively, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated March 16th, 2017.
Thank you. Representative Hack moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 3/16/17. Is there any discussion?
Is this okay? I want to make sure I get this
Mr.
Chair.
Yes.
Okay. Can I ask Sherry Maelstrom or Representative Maelstrom to explain exactly?
This isn't her bill.
This isn't the
this
bill.
This is a different bill. Right.
Different bill.
Okay, sorry.
Because I reversed the order, and so sorry.
Okay, and I checked it off. Okay, thank you.
So we're in 3-1.
I just don't want to mess
abundance
anything up.
Of caution.
No, we appreciate your asking, too, so that's okay. So any other questions or discussions? No further? Is there objections to adopting the amendment? Okay, if not, the amendment is adopted. So now...
Chair Lively, I move House Bill 3106 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hack moves House Bill 3106 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, hearing none, please call the roll.
Representative Bynum?
Aye.
Representative Mabee?
Aye.
Representative Huff?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom?
Aye.
Representative
Brock Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hack?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Lively?
Aye. So the motion passes. Close the work session, and I would ask Representative Huffman to carry this. That's all right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
We just go in.
Very good. So now we're going to go back to, on our agenda, we're going back to House Bill 3404.
Got it.
I'm going to work. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3404. Okay. So first, you want to just remind everybody what this is before we get started on the other parts of the discussion?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, House Bill 3404 requires children under age 2 to be properly secured with a child safety system in a rear-facing position. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There is a Dash 1 amendment that exempts children who are 1 year or older immediately before the effective date of the act. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. So the same bill we discussed earlier reintroduced. So we have a Dash 1 amendment. Representative Maelstrom, do you?
Would you let me to go to down there and
you can just do it from right there if you want.
Okay.
You don't have to go down there unless you're more comfortable going down there.
Okay. As you all know, I'm Sherry Maelstrom, representing House District 27, Southwest Portland and Beaverton. I'm here today, you know, to we try this again. We've done this before for House Bill 3404. We have a new bill number. There is no amendment on the bill. The purpose of the bill is to align the recommendations made by the American Academy of Pediatrics to current law. The recommendations have been made since 2011. That was 6 years ago. All parents have been hearing in all their well baby appointments for the last 6 years that it's important to keep them there till age 2. So that's what this bill basically does. Current law requires that only children ages 1 or younger are required to be rear facing. So that's the change. However, the Injury Prevention Journal in 2007 found that children under the age of 2 are 75% less likely to die or be severely injured if they are rear facing. We want people to, you know, get going with doing that now. Colleagues, this is a good bill intended to prevent avoidable catastrophic injuries in small children. The intent of this bill is to educate. We don't want to punish people. HB 3404 has the support of the Oregon Chief of Police and Sheriffs, who have committed before this committee and in writing, it's on OLIS, that to an educational parent to make sure that parents are aware of this change and people won't be getting tickets in the first year. Today, I ask your support of HB 3404 and to please send this bill to the House floor so we can begin educating more Oregon families and reduce unavoidable traumatic injuries in small children.
Thank you. So just so we're clear, this bill is reintroduced, but it does include the Dash 1 amendment to the original bill.
Right.
that we passed before. So the dash one amendment. So the new bill, that's all incorporated into the bill and the standard bill. So I just want to make sure people understand.
Had something to do with taking out weight, right?
Right. That took out the weight.
That was the original bill, but
original
we're not
bill.
Voting
right.
on that.
Right.
Any questions about that?
You may want to mention that there's the dash one amendment. But.
May what? No, I'm not. So, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Chair Lively. I'm sorry, wrong committee.
You messed with my head again.
I know we look a lot alike.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Wrong committee. I do this routinely in healthcare. I don't do it routinely here. Chair Lively, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments as dated 3/28/2017.
Representative Hayden moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3/28/17. Is there any discussion? Representative Hayden.
Yeah, so this is kind of a rerun at a bill that came to us earlier. There's been a little bit of clarification. The Dash 1 amendment does basically what I think it was the Dash 3 last time. I don't remember off the top of my head. But the request originally was that this bill is well-intended. I support the body of the bill, the base of the bill, but having raised and still involved with raising seven children, I know that it is very difficult to change routines for children. Extremely difficult to change routines for special needs children. Once you have them set up in a car seat facing a particular way, it is very difficult on the mother or the father to say, okay, Johnny, you've been rear-facing for 12 months, then you've been front-facing with two other car seats beside you for 6 months. And now the legislature is going to come along and say, Mom, you got to turn Johnny around for another 6 months so he can't see the TV screen. And that probably would have been okay if Johnny hadn't ever been turned front-facing. But now you've got to get potentially different car seats. You've got to turn the kid around. You're stressing the folks out, and I know because I'm one of those folks. You're stressing the folks out. And so I just asked when this original bill came, I asked, can we have a transition period, put the bill forward? I will be a strong supporter of it. The general consensus was yes. By the time it got here, that consensus had changed a little bit, and we're not going to discuss that. But today, the bill before us is different because now it has an emergency clause. So as soon as this bill drops and the governor signs it, parents will be subject to citation immediately, even though the chief of police has said is not our intent. They also said we cannot promise you that they won't be subject to citation. So I simply have written this at their resistance to delaying the law. This amendment would not delay the law. It literally grandfathers 12 months olds in to where the law would in place for kids turning 12 months, they would immediately have to be in a rear-facing car seat. The grandfather clause of the Dash 1 would simply say to parents, if your kid has been turned front-facing and is 12 months old or older, you will be able to allow them to stay front-facing without the threat of citation. That is all this amendment does. It grandfathers them in to where parents don't have to change the routine. And again, changing routine of special needs children in seats that have been specially bought for these children can be expensive and extremely difficult and difficult on parents. So I cannot support this bill without the grandfather clause of the Dash 1, but if we gave that courtesy to parents, I would support it wholeheartedly. Thank you.
People have Representative Huffman.
I really am trying to pay attention. I really
okay,
am.
Thank
because
you.
This is an important bill that we don't want to nod off on. So Representative Malmstrom had a Dash 1 that we voted on.
Mm-hmm.
And now Representative Hayden is talking about a Dash 1.
Because it's a new bill.
A different new bill.
It's a different bill.
This was your priority bill that we used.
So voted on the dash one amendment to the previous bill, which was took off the weight, changed the weight limit. That's all it did. So when we rewrote the bill, that was included in there. So it doesn't take an amendment. The bill was written that way. So the bill you submitted included the one that we had approved last, but took off.
So when you mentioned dash one, you were simply describing that it was the old bill with the dash one previously in it. Now we're to the new bill.
It's a new number with no dash.
Right.
It's a clean bill.
Right, and that's why it's only a dash one.
And thank you for the
one dash one.
Right.
There because we can't multiply dashes or ones.
Okay, I'm confused. We need to recess for 1 second because I need to talk to.
Sure, go ahead. We're back in session, so let's just make sure we're all clear on what has occurred here and where we're at. Oh, sorry, Representative Huffman.
Mr. Chair, if you would indulge, could I ask Representative Hayden to briefly, clearly, concisely tell me again what his dash one does?
Yes, you could.
Thank you, Chair Lively. So very concisely, with no history, this bill allows, assuming that 3404 gets approved and goes into law, it does have an emergency clause. Under an emergency clause bill, it would allow any child that is currently 1 year or older at the time that this is signed by the governor, allow them a very narrow grandfather clause or an exception from this bill so where that child did not have to turn around. All other children that were 11 months and 364 days years old would have to be in a rear-facing car seat until they were 2 years old. And so it would simply guarantee the word from our sheriffs from intent not to give citation to these narrow
small group.
This small group of children are exempt from the possibility of citation. That's all this is doing. The bill would still, it would still go in effect. All one-year-olds would get in their car seat rear-facing. They would stay there till two. Just children that have already turned and the parents have already bought that car seat would give an exemption for that narrow amount of children to do it as their child grows up.
I was going to do a follow-up question, but you answered it. So when they turn two, then they fall under the bill requirements.
Absolutely. Yep.
Thank you.
So, Representative Brock-Smith, did you have a...
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative Hayden, this narrows it, and it does not affect the overall bill that was presented in any way.
No.
Thank you.
Representative Malmstrom.
You know, we're arguing over a little tiny thing here, you know. But I guess in the long run, what I would not want on my conscience, I don't want to hear that, say, you know, this fall, an 18-month-old child was severely injured because they got the message that they got an exception to changing their car seat around. I'd rather have a few people get tickets that I don't think they're going to get than see even one child unnecessarily injured or killed.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Bynum.
So the way I'm thinking of it is, number one, I'm leery of verbal assurances from law enforcement. That's just my life experience. I feel whatever the law is, I try to follow it. And I feel like as a parent with seats still in my car, I want to make sure I get it right. And I think that child safety is very important. And it you do get into a routine, so much so that sometimes I've even admitted to forgetting strapping the kids in because something in the routine gets off. And so I think I want to make sure that what we do in terms of policy, that you make sure that compliance is just as much a part of the policy as the policy itself. And so I think that there are pieces that we can build in to make it stronger so that we have good compliance, we have a good transition. And I don't think that this is, I think that this is a reasonable request. So
thank you. So Representative Hayden, if I might.
Yes, sir.
So I'm just trying to understand, and I understand what it says, but now I'm trying to understand, because what we talked earlier about the ability of law enforcement to enforce or not enforce, and whether they do it the first time, but I'm trying to understand, so that an officer comes up to a car, and what this law says, if they were 12 on the date it takes effect.
12 months.
Right. But so how is the officer, with the information they're going to have available to them when they're standing there at the car, going to be able to sort that out, that that child was? Because this is going to be sometime after the law has passed. So they'll have the date, but how do they confirm? Are they going to have to ask for a birth certificate? I'm just trying to understand from a practical standpoint the position we're putting law enforcement in.
Fair question. But first of all, most of us have had children. Children between the ages of 0 months and 24 months can be varied a lot by weight, size, whatever. So disregard this whole bill. How do they do it now? They rely on the parent to say that. And if they cite, it goes to court. And if the parent wants to resist that, then they have to bring the birth certificate. There is no way for an officer not to rely on the parent, and it wouldn't change the interaction. Whether we do this amendment or whether we don't do this amendment would not change the interaction at the scene at all.
Thank you. Any further discussion of the motion to amend or the motion to adopt the Nash 1 Amendment? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Well, I guess I'll just express for the record, this is really a hard one for me, because I do feel like you, if it's about safety, we would want to include all kids, and I don't want to see parents ticketed, but I want them to get why we passed a law that impacts kids that are between 1 and 2 years old. And I have heard that the seats are actually, my youngest is 20, so it's been a long time, but the seats go, you know, that they can face forward or back now. So it seems like it would be relatively small in order to, I think it was like a 4-to-1, you know, safety, that mortality rate on if you were facing forward as opposed to back. That's pretty significant in terms, you know, that compared to the angst that parents go through when you got a screaming kid who's used to facing a certain way. So, you know, on one hand, I am very sympathetic to the base bill. And on the other hand, both in terms of process, a lot of angst around process around here, really trying to hear various people, and also letting perfection be the enemy of the good, I guess. You know, I'm sympathetic to what you're saying. So I'm really torn. I'm just like sitting here going, oh, which way am I going to go? I just got to say that for the record. I'm very torn. I think you have both made very good arguments on this.
Yeah. Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. To the bill, I'm understanding.
Talking about the amendment right now.
I understand, but in order for the question, I need to also discuss the amendment is for. If you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair, and that is because of the safety concerns, right? Mm-hmm. This bill is already taking. Currently, you have to be the person who is under 1 year, right? That's current law is 1 year. We're taking it to 2, correct?
Yeah.
So then my question would be, I appreciate the fact that we're strengthening, because this bill has an emergency clause, and as a former county commissioner and city councilor, I know that officers get the new updates and they go out and they're doing their thing and they're citing people and they're not even going to get the memo, okay? Secondly, we are strengthening the bill. We've been going along until this point with the folks, with the persons under 1 year, and we're going to change that to 2. We're just allowing that first 12, the folks that are at under 12 years of age to continue with the current bill or current law. That's all we're doing with the Dash 1s. And I don't want to have those folks and those mothers and fathers and grandmothers to have to go out and buy car seats and go out and purchase and spend money when they don't have to. So that's my point.
Was there a question there I missed?
Yeah. I don't know.
Just checking. I guess I answered my own question.
Okay, that's... Well, I thought you had. I was letting him talk the last time what got us in
trouble. Yeah, I think it was.
True story.
I think so. Representative Malmstrom.
I'd just like to speak to Representative Brock Smith's comment about the car seats. Most car seats, if you buy a car seat at one, you've got to buy another car seat anyway. So they wouldn't generally have to, you know, buy another car seat for this. Now, there's special needs kids. That's different. But again, parents have heard this from the beginning. This should not be news to anybody about this would be very, very different. I would support this wholeheartedly if this was a new law we were implementing or a new, you know, practice. But these parents have heard this from the day their child was born, and any children they had previously that's 6 years or younger have heard the importance of keeping it rear-facing till two. So there is that. So I don't want anybody to think that everybody's got to go out and that has a 1 to 2 year old has to go buy a new car seat. Mm-hmm. If they want to get a car, if they're really strapped and they feel like a car seat doesn't work as well, there's places to help with car seats.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Malmstrom, the recommendation from pediatricians will remain that the children should remain rear-facing to two. What we're talking about is the ability for law enforcement to cite a parent.
Right.
Okay. So I think if we can, Mr. Chair, if I can follow up. If we can make a distinction between the fact that we're talking about law enforcement citations, we're talking about building compliance, versus changing a recommendation from a pediatrician, I think those are three really separate questions. If we vote in the amendment, we are not saying to change the recommendation
to one year old.
So the recommendation stays the same. We're simply talking about the citation, and we're talking about the parent's ability to make that choice in between 12 months and 1 day up until 12 months and 364 days. That's the period that we're talking about. Yeah.
Chair Lively, can I answer her question? That's correct. You're allowing those parents with a child between 1 and 2 to decide they can keep their child in a less safe position for the next year. That's what the law will allow them to do, is make an unsafe decision.
Okay. I don't want to belabor this,
it looks like you're going to, though.
One response.
Go right ahead.
The National Practice Safety Standards for America are currently met by the current law that we have without this bill. That is 1 year of age. That is the recommended standard. There are other studies that can be looked at, and they will have different results. But that's the base standard that was presented by...
Yes.
So I don't want to get in an argument about
that.
But I just think it's fair to say that the current law meets the current standard.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Well, I would just like to say that I'm looking at the experts from OHSU who are nodding their head no, so I don't think so. And again, I want to get back to perfection is the enemy of the good. Not based on your last statement, because I believe that's not correct, but based on perfection is the enemy of the good, I also think that your original amendment, I recall, was in like January of 2019. This would be, the longest it could be is somebody who's born right when it's being signed in July 2017 to go out to July 2018, and most of those people would age out of that exemption before that. So I do think that you've narrowed the universe some.
I have.
So if you see me vote yes on your amendment, it is not because I believe that the standards are for 1 year.
Okay.
It's because I think I remember from testimony, and I'm looking in the audience here, that the recommendation is clearly 2 years old now. And again, I want to appreciate Representative Malmstrom bringing this and seeking to ensure that the law covers the most safety possible. I get that. And we operate in an imperfect world here. So.
Yes, we do. Anything else? I just remind committee members, this probably isn't the toughest issue we're going to have to deal with. We probably spend as much time as we would on some of the tougher issues, but I appreciate the conversation. And at the end of the day, it's the parents are in the position of making it, and I know some parents already keep their kids sitting backwards because they have been told that's the best practice. And so if there's no further discussions, I'll call for a roll call vote, please.
Representative Bynum?
Aye.
Representative Hayden.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Kenny Guyer.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
I'm going to vote aye for one reason. OHSU, and I have been consulting, and the other part of the thing is I want this bill to pass out on a universal vote. I don't want to have all this whatever we've been having out on the floor. I don't want this on the floor. This is not how I really feel. You've all heard, but I'm going to vote yes because I want the record to show we could all get it together and vote for a simple car seat bill.
Thank you.
Representative Brock Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Peluso.
Aye.
Chair Lively.
Aye. So the motion passes. So, oh, she's written the amendment.
Okay.
She didn't think we could figure it out.
The dash one amendment passes.
Yes.
Okay.
Chair Lively, I move House Bill 3404 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Peluso moves House Bill 3404 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further any discussion?
Please.
Okay. Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Bynum?
Aye.
Representative Hayden?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Guyer?
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom?
Aye.
Representative Brock Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hack?
Aye.
Vice Chair Peluso?
Aye.
Chair Leibniz?
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Malmstrom, would you still please carry the bill?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Okay, so close the work session. I'm going to open an informational hearing and invite up Dr. Eric
Pakulak.
Okay, very good, from the University of Oregon Brain Development Lab. Now he's going to explain to us all this struggle we went through. It started way earlier than that.
I'll give it a shot.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Lively, committee members, my name is Eric Pakulak. I'm the acting director of the Brain Development Lab at the University of Oregon. It's a great honor and a great pleasure to be here in front of you today to talk a bit about our work on neuroplasticity and specifically our work with Head Start of Lane County in developing a program that we've shown to strengthen preschool. So the Brain Development Lab at the University of Oregon for more than 30 years has studied neuroplasticity, or how plastic or changeable the brain is. That predates my time in the lab, and it's very important for me to acknowledge our director emerita, who just retired, Dr. Helen Neville. She's a world-famous developmental cognitive neuroscientist and also has a great passion for using scientific evidence to inform policy, and so it's my great pleasure to be here representing our work. This is essentially an accumulation of her life's work. I also meant to say, it's my understanding that you ask questions at any time.
We might, yes.
Is that correct?
Are you comfortable with that?
Please do.
Okay.
And I think I'm going to have to move through some sections a bit faster because of time. And also, my apologies if I'm telling you things that you already know. So the main points I'm hoping to convey are, first of all, that the developing brain is very plastic. But we consider neuroplasticity as a double-edged sword. And so what we mean by that is that it confers the possibility for systems to be vulnerable. So I'm going to talk about the effects of early adversity, the effects of poverty on the developing brain. But it's really important in talking about that evidence to consider the other side of that double-edged sword, and that is that the brain is very enhanceable. Neuroplasticity, confers the possibility for the brain to be enhanced with, for example, high-quality preschools such as Head Start and other programs. I'm going to show you evidence from our studies that engaging parents in the home environment is an excellent way to strengthen preschool via what we call two-generation programs, simultaneously working with parents and children. And this is work that we've done, again, with Head Start of Lane County in our community. And then finally, I just want to leave you with a message that high-quality early childhood education is a good investment, and just provide a little bit of the evidence for the record on that. So I'd like to start by telling you a little bit about how we study the brain. We study how the brain is working in preschool-age children while they're doing things, and I'm going to show you how we do that. I'm going to talk about, as I said, the effects of early adversity on brain development, so the effects of poverty on the developing brain, and two systems that we focus on primarily are language and stress. So you might have heard the idea of toxic stress, chronic stress being toxic to the developing brain. So I'll talk a little bit more in more detail about that. And then closely related to that are systems important for self-regulation, including attention. And these are really important systems for school readiness and a whole wide range of outcomes into adulthood. So they're very important systems and also very plastic systems. And then, as I said, I'll tell you about our work with Head Start of Lane County, developing and assessing this program. And I'll talk about investment. Many of you probably know a six-year-old, four-year-old, five-year-old, six-year-old. That child has more connections between brain cells than any of us in this and that's one of the primary ways that experience can affect brain development. The idea is you use it or you lose it. So you have this over-connectivity between brain cells early in development, and the experiences you have strengthen certain connections and weaken others. A really important point here is that that's not universal across the whole brain. So this happens across different time periods in different parts of the brain. And we use that information to inform our studies. And so what that means is that different brain systems have different profiles of plasticity. So some are pretty constrained. The effects of experience are pretty constrained. Others are modifiable by and dependent on experience during particular time points. And these are the parts of the brain, these brain systems that we're particularly interested in. And I'm going to talk to you about language and attention today. And then some are modifiable throughout life. And those are, frankly, a little less interesting for the work that we're doing with preschoolers. So now I'd like to tell you about how we study the brain. It's a technique called event-related potentials. Right now, you have about 100 billion or so brain cells, neurons, in your brain right now, connected each one up to about 10,000 other brain cells. So you have literally trillions of connections in your brain right now. Amazing, right? Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And your brain's not as big as you think it is either. It's about the size of your two fists put together. Consistency of room temperature butter. We do a lot of outreach with schools. I have a bucket of brains. Go talk to school kids. I didn't bring the bucket of brains because I didn't create some problems, I think, for the rest of the at any rate. And so the way brain cells communicate are via chemicals and electricity.
Jody, the question.
And so right now, by virtue of your brain cells firing away, you have enough electricity in your scalp to light a dim light bulb. And that's not a commentary on intelligence or political affiliation. Literally, they would all be dim. And so we can eavesdrop on the brain as it's working.
How about those of us that have more exposed scalp?
Yeah. And so we can amplify the naturally occurring activity at the surface. When we talk to parents about this technique, we use the metaphor of a stethoscope. It's akin to a stethoscope. You go to a doctor's office, and that's just amplifying naturally occurring activity at the surface. This is a really powerful technique for studying how the brain works in children for a couple of reasons. First of all, things happen fast in the brain, and we're measuring brain activity once every 4 milliseconds, once every 4/1000th of a second with this technique. So it gets us really great information about when things are happening in the brain. Another reason this is a wonderful technique for studying the brains of small children, in addition to making really cute pictures when you're giving a presentation, is that we don't have to have an active task. So if one of you fine folks were in one of my experiments, I'd have you holding a video game controller and making some decisions about sentences, and it's a really boring task, I promise you. But you would do it. I'm a nice guy. I'm also paying you cold, hard cash. That helps. But it's much more difficult to get a preschooler to do a boring task. So we have to be a bit clever. But we can do so. So this is just a quick example of how we study language processing in the brains of preschoolers. You're watching a cartoon. Some of you might have seen Pingu. He exists in the real world. We got permission to modify Pingu with some language that goes on top of it. And if you listen closely to the language, you'll hear some interesting things. And then I'll show you how that allows us to study the how the brain processes language.
They is jumping up and down on the bed. They jump off their beds and onto the floor. Mina and Dupreme Roding clip Rang and Bila on those their hoop. Minga and Ramfu tap clicks for this their keemfulp. The kids are going to have fun. They is not crying anymore. Pinga turns on the radio in this their house. Pinga turns up the penguin really loud.
So, you probably noticed some interesting problems with the language, some errors. And that's essentially how we can use this system to study how the brain is processing language in real time. And so, you might have heard, for example, a sentence like, the babies won't drink the milk from their bottles, which is a perfectly good sentence. And you might have heard a sentence that has some sort of violation, in this case, sort of a violation of meaning or semantics. The babies won't play the milk from their bottles. Babies don't tend to play milk. And what we can do is we can look at the brain's response. So this is averaged over many examples of hearing the same word. And what we get is a brainwave. And so that's time in milliseconds. And so, again, very excellent temporal resolution. We get a brainwave, and then we're comparing the brain's response to the same word when it creates a violation. And what we get is a difference in the brain response that corresponds to processing meaning. And we get a different pattern of brain response corresponding to processing grammar, for example. And so we think evidence is very important. And so this is the basis of the evidence that I'm going to show you today, including evidence for the efficacy of our program. It's the difference in the brain response as measured by brainwaves. The other brain system that we study that's very important for school readiness is attention. And specifically what we mean is sustained selective attention. It's what most of you are doing right now. You're paying attention to various degrees to what I'm saying, and that's perfectly understandable. And it's relatively easy right now because I'm sitting in front of you with a microphone and saying things that are hopefully at least somewhat interesting. But now imagine that we're at a really crowded party, and you don't care about all the fun because you want to hear about neuroplasticity, of course. And so in this really crowded environment, I hope you've all had this experience, you can actually have a conversation with me, and you can actually use your brain to turn up the volume on what I'm saying, essentially, right? And what your brain's actually doing is also turning down the volume on what's going on around you. And this is a very powerful skill, and it's also like a spotlight. So now pretend like you're not as interested in what I have to say about the brain, and they just put some food out, and you're really hungry, but you're not rude, so you can look at me and smile, oh, neuroplasticity, that's great, and you can shift this spotlight of attention to the side, correct? And monitor what's going on over here, or you hear your name in a conversation and you want to know what they're saying about you, but you can, oh, neuroplasticity, oh, that's very interesting. And so this is like a spotlight that you can control. And now, imagine you're a preschooler going into a classroom environment for the first time. This is a very powerful skill, and this is part of an umbrella of skills called self-regulation and also include executive function. Nice to see the nods there. And this is a very powerful skill for school readiness and predicts a whole host of outcomes into adulthood. We can also measure this in the lab. This is a visual version of this that provides evidence for one side of the two sides of plasticity. And what we're doing here is we're looking at the brain's response to flashes of light over here in the periphery. And sometimes we say pay attention over here and ignore over here. Sometimes we say pay attention over here and ignore over here. And basically, the punchline, what we get is at a tenth of a second, a neural enhancement, an enhanced brain response to something you're paying attention to with this spotlight of attention. Okay? And when we look at, for example, people who were born deaf processing visual attention, we see an enhanced response, even greater than typically developing adults who were not born deaf. So what that suggests is that these very important processes are enhanceable with vastly different early experience. Now, we also have to be really clever to study this in preschoolers. So we use an auditory version of this task where children, we do this with adults too, by the way, are asked to listen to two stories at the same time. So you have the nice cap on, you've had some goldfish and M&Ms, you're nice and comfortable in a chair, and you've got one story coming from this speaker and one story coming from this speaker, and we say, okay, pay attention to Blue Kangaroo and ignore Harry the dog. And it sounds something like this if both speakers are working.
It was you, Blue Kangaroo. Blue Kangaroo belonged to Lily. Okay. He was her very own kangaroo. Sometimes when Lily...
So that's the super easy version because I don't have the standard speakers. Now imagine you have two stories plus those baws and buzzes. The punchline here is that small children can do this task. and even children as young as 3, 4, and 5 years old, we see here the shaded area is a significant difference. In other words, again, an enhanced brain response with paying attention. And we see this even in preschool-age children. This is a very important time for the development of these skills. And so this is something, again, that we've reported in children this age. Now, one interesting point here concerns who these children are and who, when we talk about, as cognitive neuroscience, when we talk about this is how the brain works, who do we study? We study undergrads. We study children of professors, okay? Over 90%, something like that in a recent estimate of studies of how the brain works are studying undergraduate college students or children of professors. We're very interested in the effects of experience on brain development and how different environmental experiences can affect brain development. And so the way that we try to characterize that is by measuring socioeconomic status. So broadly speaking, your parents' education and occupation level when you were a child predicts a whole range of outcomes into adulthood. Again, this is just a broad statistical generalization, but it's one of the best ways that we have for trying to characterize a pretty complex environmental situation associated with growing up in poverty. A couple of important points here. This is just a sample. I'm going to show you some real data on this. But first of all, the steepness of the gradient matters. So the greater the difference between higher and lower socioeconomic status groups in a society predicts the difference in outcomes. This is true at the level of countries. This is true across the United States at the state level. It's even true at the neighborhood level, some interesting work up in Canada. Another really important point is that the entire society is affected, so more equal societies do better. And I think this is a relevant question, relevant issue for many reasons.
Chair.
Right now.
Sure, Representative Bynum, excuse me.
Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I have to get my procedure right here. Thank you so much. I am curious if there were any Asian countries included in your studies. I'm pretty sensitive to the, I see Cuba there and I see New Zealand and I'm not sure the NI. I see Great Britain.
Representative Bynum, Chair Leiblich. That's an excellent question and a very important one. I want to note that this is a representative graph, and Helen loves Cuba and added Cuba to this. But there is a wealth of evidence and increasing evidence for these patterns in a variety of countries. Off the top of my head, I know of studies in Southeast Asia that show a similar pattern, by which I mean a similar gradient in outcomes in Vietnam and Laos, I believe. Increasingly evidence from South American countries and African countries as well. So that's a very important consideration, but increasingly we're seeing this pattern across a wide range of cultures.
So may I ask a follow-up? So the reason it's important to me to see the diversity of cultures represented is because we don't have the same economic systems. And so I wonder, like, the first thing that came to my mind, I thought, well, China, they don't have the same capitalist system that we have. And so my assumption is that they have differing degrees of socioeconomic strata, so to speak. And so I just wonder if the outcomes that they're seeing are the same as the outcomes of Western society or in, say, sub-Saharan Africa, if we're seeing those same things in. How do we translate to what we need to do here in the United States with respect to diversity and trying to get all of these varying factors up to the highest level that we can? So.
That's also a very important point, a very important question, and I want to be careful not to go beyond my own knowledge and the data, because those are certainly very complex questions in terms of politics. Perhaps one piece of evidence that I can speak to concerns inequality in educational outcomes. And the evidence that I'm aware of, it's certainly a complex situation, but suggests that countries, for example, like Finland, now there are, to be sure, considerable political differences between the United States and Scandinavian countries, but one but it goes beyond political systems, is the point that I would try to make. Finland is an example that comes to mind because they invest very heavily in early education. These countries invest very heavily in maternal and paternal leave. Finland invests very heavily in education to the point that there's a lot of competition to be teachers, and teachers are paid as much or more as than doctors and lawyers. And so acknowledging your point, but I don't want to go too far because of my own limitations. I think it goes beyond political systems, though certainly I think that it's fair to say that that's involved. So a social democratic system that perhaps taxes more heavily but also invests more heavily in education, there's evidence to suggest that that pays off.
Thank you.
Yeah. So it's important to acknowledge when I'm talking about socioeconomic status that this is a very complex situation, and high and low, quote-unquote, typical families vary in a whole range of dimensions. And we do our best to try to unpack these different dimensions with questionnaires and other data. But what I want to focus on now are, the two primary mechanisms that are very important for school readiness, very important for outcomes, and these are also a focus of the program that I'm going to tell you about that we've developed working with Head Start. And they are also, in addition to being foundational skills, they're also most impacted by early adversity or poverty, and that's language and stress and self-regulation. There are a whole host of differences in language environment as a function of socioeconomic status. I want to remind you these are broad statistical generalizations. We work with so many wonderful families, it's very important to point out that these are just broad statistical generalizations and in no way, shape, or form saying this means that family X is this. Okay? But broadly speaking, there are differences in both the amount and variety of vocabulary, so language input, grammatical complexity. It's not just the amount of words, but it's the quality of the words. So child-directed speech versus speech directed to other adults is a very important factor in language development. The purpose of the speech, so conversational and turn-taking versus child directives, uses of questions versus directives, and sharing books. And not just the amount of time spent sharing books, but the ways in which parents and caregivers are sharing books with children. You might have heard of the famous study by Hart and Risley, the 30 million word gap, basically showing that there are systematic differences in the amount of vocabulary, and as you, no surprise, this predicts both the ultimate vocabulary level and the rate of growth of vocabulary in children. Some great work from Stanford University is showing these effects as young as 18 months of age. Studies of a wide range of different aspects of cognition have shown that language is one of the most strongest and most consistently documented relationships in terms of poverty or socioeconomic status. And studies are increasingly showing relationships between brain structure and function. So this part of the brain up here, the left inferior frontal gyrus, Broca's area, is a very important part of the brain for language processing. And some studies from the University of Washington are showing that the structure and function of this important area varies depending on socioeconomic status. Some work from our lab is showing we're finding some similar results. What's interesting here is that we study primarily children from the lower socioeconomic status end of the spectrum, so these gradient relationships are evident even in a sample of relatively lower socioeconomic status children. This is documenting the relationship with receptive language. And then we're seeing similar patterns in terms of brain function. It's important to note this is unpublished data, but what we're seeing here is the brain response to some of those weird grammatical violations that you might have heard in the Pingu cartoon. And essentially what we see is that children from higher socioeconomic status backgrounds, this is a map of where the effects are on the scalp, and this is consistent with a more mature, more rapidly maturing function for language processing in children. And we're also finding that these differences may endure into... Was there a question?
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to make a comment about that when we had the subject-verb agreement disagree in the Penguin. I thought to myself, interesting, when I go back to my family in South Carolina, that's how we talk.
Mm-hmm.
That's standard, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but here in this room, that's not standard. And so for some communities, you have to switch back and forth. I think they call it code switching.
Oh, that's a, Representative Bynum, that's a very interesting point. There's a lot of emerging study. I just came back from a conference where I talked about this a lot on African-American English and differences in brain processing. And there's a researcher doing some really wonderful work. She's at Georgia State looking at code switching, just that, code switching in African-American children, code switching between standard American English and African-American English, because you're absolutely right. That's a very highly regularized linguistic system with its own rules. And increasingly, it's the focus of studies like this. That is a very, very important point. We did our best, in terms of the design of this study, we did our best to create violations that would be violations of any known dialect in English, but we've certainly gotten comments like that and realized that we have to keep that in mind.
Okay. So for the chair, I don't want to poke too much to make this about one group. I just want to make sure that the information that we're presented is not always skewed towards a dominant culture without appreciation for other cultures that exist in our society. And we often tend to assume that one thing is right, and we don't have a view on other things that are happening. So when I heard that, I was like, oh, that's what we have to do every day is the code switch, and that's what we have to teach. I personally have to teach my children to code switch every single day, depending on the environment that they're in. So I won't bring it up too much more, but I just want to make it for the record that when we have presentations that we're not accepting dominant culture as the only right thing that we have in our society. So
thank you.
Representative Bynum, again, thank you. That's a very important point. An additional note, this researcher at Georgia State is studying some of the potential advantages of code switching. So there's something called the bilingual advantage hypothesis that suggests that perhaps switching between two language systems in the brain might confer other advantages because you're going back and forth like that. So that's a very important point. Thank you. So we're finding evidence that these relationships between early adversity and brain function endure into adulthood as well for language. This is the brain response to some of those violations at a tenth of a second, and it varies as a function of childhood socioeconomic status. I'm going to move a little faster through this so that I have plenty of time to tell you about our program with Head Start. The other important system that's highly affected by early experience is brain function for stress regulation. The problem here, if you will, is that the brain is the central organ of the stress response system, and the same parts of the brain that are very important for maintaining a good stress regulation and stress response system are also very important for aspects of learning and memory, aspects of emotional processing, and aspects of behavioral control and emotional control. So this is the basis for the characterization of chronic stress in development as toxic to the developing brain. The parts of the brain that are important for both include the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is very important for aspects of self-regulation, including attention, judgment and decision-making, impulse control and working memory. Again, these are all very foundational skills that are very important for school readiness, and in fact have more predictive power for school readiness and academic success than, for example, IQ. In terms of the stress response system, the prefrontal cortex is important for down-regulating, so it's important to chill out after a stressful event, and that's what the prefrontal cortex is important for. The hippocampus, so named because it looks like a seahorse, is important for learning and memory, formation of new memories, also important for helping you chill out after a stressful response. The amygdala is connected to the hippocampus, and it is very important for emotional processing, including regulation and learning, perceptions of potential threats, real or perceived. Your brain is what decides what is a threat to you, and aspects of fear, anxiety, and aggression. And this is important for upregulation of the stress response. So the non-stress default condition that we're hopefully all experiencing right now is basically your prefrontal cortex is regulating things for you, okay? And it's regulating also your amygdala. It's helping you inhibit inappropriate actions, and it's helping regulate attention, thought, and emotion. Moderate stress is good. Some stress is good. So moderate increases in stress actually help you focus, help attention, help executive function. And it's when you get this rise above moderate levels that you get something of a problem, if you will. So the amygdala, when you encounter a stressor, impairs this regulatory function of the prefrontal cortex, and it strengthens the function of this reactive part of the brain. So if a tiger were to walk through that door right now,
I'm the butt of the jokes. I believe that.
So, hypothetically, if a tiger were to walk through that door right now, your amygdala would set off a cascade of chemical responses throughout your body that would help you mobilize a response. You would, of course, quit listening to what I have to say, however interesting it is, and you would mobilize a response to survive and to escape the tiger. And so this is, of course, a good thing when tigers walk through doors. But the problem is it's a bad thing when this is chronic. And again, emphasizing that these are broad statistical generalizations, broadly speaking, aspects of environment that are associated with early adversity and poverty tend to be more chaotic, less predictable, in some cases more dangerous. And so when your stress response system is turned on for a long period of time, basically it creates wear and tear. This chemical cascade creates wear and tear on these brain systems and on the body itself. So one way that chronic stress can affect this relationship is essentially you have, over time, you develop a more reactive amygdala. So you're more reactive, you're more sensitive to potential threats in your environment, which makes sense, right? If you're growing up in an environment that is potentially threatening, then you're going to develop this hypervigilance and sensitivity to threat. So it's not just a deficit per se, but rather it's an adaptation, a very important adaptation to environment. And in the literature, it's known as hypervigilance, and it's this more reactive profile. And so that's, of course, adaptive if you're in a threatening environment. But then the problem here is that it's not adaptive if you're in a classroom environment. And again, back to the idea that these same brain systems are very important for self-regulation, emotional regulation, and attention. So that's essentially the issue here. Increasingly, we're seeing evidence in human studies. There's a wealth of evidence from studies of rodents and non-human primates, but we're seeing evidence in humans for the effects of early adversity on brain structure and function. So this is some evidence showing correlations in the amygdala and hippocampus, the structure of these brain areas as a function of socioeconomic status. This is showing the importance of parental nurturance and of timing. So we see this relationship with parental nurturance, differences in parental nurturance at age 4, but not at age 8. So again, suggesting that early experience and parents are very important in this equation. Now back to our research. As I showed you earlier, we've documented that there's this early brain response, this enhanced brain response at a tenth of a second when you're paying attention to something. And as I said, The children that we studied in that first experiment were primarily from higher socioeconomic status backgrounds. They were, you know, professors' kids. So what we did was we felt it was very important to go beyond the university community and go out into the environment. And we looked at the brain response to the same stimuli in children from lower socioeconomic status backgrounds. And what we see is we don't see the same brain response. So it's these important brain systems are vulnerable to the effects of early adversity. Now, as I said, we can look at mechanisms, actually, and the point here of this graph is on the right side, the unattended. The difference was that children from lower socioeconomic status backgrounds were not suppressing distracting information in the periphery in the same way. And back to this point about it being adaptive, that makes sense, right? If you're potentially growing up in a more chaotic, less predictable environment, it makes sense not to suppress distracting information in the periphery. The problem is that that is not as adaptive when you're moving into a classroom setting. So,
can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
I don't think I understood that correctly because it seems counterintuitive to me. It seems like if a kid is growing up in a very chaotic environment, their adaptive strategy would be to suppress all of that buzz. That's what I would think, because that's the way you survive, is to not be bombarded by so much stimuli. I would think you would be suppressing it.
Yeah, that's
not what happens?
That's an interesting point, but that's not. That doesn't appear to be what happens based on the evidence that we have. And the idea is, so another way of thinking about it would be, if you're in a really dangerous environment, by which I mean there could be danger around the corner, then it's adaptive to pay more attention to what's happening over here, because that could be a life or death.
And so that's why when they get into a classroom environment, their antennae are up all over and it's just too much stimuli and it's hard to focus.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. So again, a very important point in terms of neuroplasticity is that these same brain systems that are vulnerable are also enhanceable. And this is what drove us to begin working with Head Start of Lane County and developing ways based on the evidence I've just discussed to enhance preschool education. So some evidence from Phil Fisher, whom I highly recommend that you get to come talk to, you if at all possible. He's at the University of Oregon, the Oregon Social Learning Center, and he's a pioneer in working with parents, especially working with foster parents and developing programs for foster parents to help foster parents and foster children. And what he and his colleagues at the Oregon Social Learning Center down in Eugene showed was that the stress response system, this chemical cortisol, is changeable with an evidence-based program for foster families. So one piece of evidence that these brain systems are changeable or enhanceable. There are several older studies of higher quality preschool that have outcome data into adulthood. One is called the Perry Preschool Project from the 60s that was a comprehensive program for preschoolers that also importantly included health and family support. The other is from the 70s, and it's called the Apsidarian Project, and it's an intensive intervention starting in infancy and through kindergarten. Spendy, to be sure. I'm going to speak to that at the end. But full day, full year, supplemented by home visits. So again, some aspect of working with the parents. And what they found was short-term benefits in aspects of IQ, for example, with some degree of fade out, to be honest. But what's interesting is when you start looking at these long-term effects, I mean into folks in their 20s and 30s, you see increases in high school graduation rates, increases in employment and income, decreases in welfare, decreases in incarceration. So this is some of the evidence that speaks to early childhood education being a good investment. Now, finally, to our work with Head Start of Lane County, I can't emphasize enough how wonderful those folks are. We went to them about 13 years ago now and said, hey, we study neuroplasticity and selective attention. We're interested in testing some theories about that and also working with parents. It's going to be really demanding on your staff. It's going to be really difficult. Here's what we want to do. And they said, come, let's do it. Annie Soto, the director of Head Start Lane County, absolutely wonderful. So this is the result of over a decade of research, again, working with Head Start Lane County. And what we've developed is a successful two-generation intervention. What that means is working simultaneously with parents and children and integrating those two programs. And so I'm going to describe the program and provide evidence for that program, and I'm going to tell you about an exciting current direction in our research in that program. So first, it involves weekly child training called the Brain Train. We hired an experienced school teacher named Scott Klein, who came in and worked with us to develop really fun activities for kids to train attention and self-regulation and emotional regulation. These cute young ladies here are training their attention and self-regulation skills by carefully observing snails. Lots of really fun activities for kids on the Brain Train. And at the same time, Jessica Fanning in our lab was working with Phil Fisher and others at Oregon Social Learning Center to take one of their programs for parents. It's an 8-week parenting program, initially designed for foster parents, as I mentioned earlier, and Jessica adapted it for use with typically developing families, so not foster families, and added a few evidence-based aspects, especially pertaining to language and stress and self-regulation. The Brain Train and the core components, we do a variety of fun activities that emphasize positive social interaction, metacognitive awareness. Preschoolers are very smart. They know that they have brains. We talk about, hey, you have your brain. You can use your brain to control your body. You can use your brain to change how you're feeling, self-regulation. And then we specifically train aspects of focused attention, including dealing with distractions. So we have some kids doing one really difficult task over here, and the other kids are doctor distractors, and their job in life for that 5-minute period is to distract these kids, balancing balloons, making noise, whatever. Everybody trades, so everybody does the same thing. And it's scaffolded over time so that with time, children are developing these skills and strategies for maintaining attention and suppressing this distracting information, which, again, should be good in a classroom environment. There's a poster, so what does it feel like to be paying attention? Your body is still, your eyes and ears are focused, and your brain is thinking. We talk about ways to deal with things that aren't pleasant, like when you're frustrated about something, you can shrug your shoulders and you can say, oh, well, and you can think about, you can redirect yourself to think about something that you can do. Works well in the lab as well when your computer crashes at the wrong time. And then the parent training, we have 8 weekly 2-hour meetings. It's an interactive small group setting. Many parents say it's like a date night. We do free food, free child care. You get an opportunity to sit in a room with other parents and just talk about, I mean, one of the first pages in our handout is, you know, there's no manual for parenting, right? And so just sort of share common struggles. And then we have a trained interventionist who leads the group through discussions of different strategies that we provide. It's really important to note that we don't stand up in white lab coats and say this is what science says you should do with your child. We're very respective of individual parenting cultures and just say, hey, here are some tips you might try. So the goals include strengthening positive relationships, so using things like specific praise that get children to pay more attention to what the parents are saying, monitoring and improving the ways that parents are using language with their kids. We talk about the evidence on language development. Emotional regulation, we talk a lot about the amygdala and the hippocampus and how they're connected and what that means for your preschooler and some strategies you can use in different situations. Talk a lot about stress, including the evidence I've discussed today, and how you can improve consistency and predictability and reduce power struggles, and that's going to reduce stress not only for the child but ultimately also for the parent as well. And then, of course, we tell them what we're doing on the Brain Train and offer ways to help support their children's developing attention and self-regulation skills. So strategies involving making choices and solving problems, which also reduces stress, by the way. Whenever you even have a sense of control, it reduces the stress level. So just giving a choice is very powerful. And then we share the activities and materials. We share what we're doing as well and encourage them to incorporate them into the home environment. Here's an example of a poster about emotional saturation where we talk about the amygdala and the hippocampus and how when your child is very emotionally saturated having a bit of a tantrum, so to speak, that's a bad time to try to reason with a child, and here are some different strategies that you can use. These are materials that we give to parents to put into the home environment. So, importantly, we did a rigorous test of this program. So these are families randomly assigned to one of three groups. One group is the program that I just described, this two-generation intervention program. The other group was Head Start alone, regular Head Start. We wanted to provide some evidence to add to the body of evidence that Head Start is effective. And then, interestingly here, we also compared it to a different two-generation approach that involved much less time with the parents. So relatively more time with the kids and relatively less time with the parents. And so only two 90-minute sessions over 8 weeks. And this is important because the pattern of results shows pretty clearly that spending more time with parents is very effective. We do a wide range of outcome measures across two visits to the lab before and after the intervention program timeline. We documented changes in parents. What you're seeing here are mean changes, these bars, and in the three groups. So in a measure of language, so we changed how parents were using language with their children. We do a videotape play dyad and code it for language. Parents were doing a better job of turn-taking with their children, which predicts good language development. Parents also showed reductions in self-reported parenting stress. So better language, less stress, fewer problem behaviors in their children, better social skills in their children. We documented for all three groups improvements in language and improvements in IQ. These are tabletop tests. And then what's most unique about our work is that we're able to get an assessment of brain function. And this is what I showed you earlier, this with the two listening to the two stories and measuring brain function for attention. And what we're able to show is children who were assigned to this group that involved working closely with the parents as well as our brain train program showed significant improvements in this early 10th of a second brain function for attention, this spotlight of attention, if you will. So pretty strong evidence that working closely with parents in this two-generation model is a pretty effective way of strengthening preschool education. Now I'd like to end by sharing with you an exciting current project that we're working on. A couple years ago, there was a call for proposals from the Department of Health and Human Services for a program called Head Start University Partnerships, Dual Generation Approaches. Honestly, this is one of those call for proposals that felt like it was written just for you. Yeah. And we just wanted to not screw it up, and happily we didn't screw it up. So it's from the Department of Health and Human Services, and what's wonderful about this, among many things, is that it's a formalized partnership. So this is a grant to us and to Head Start of Lane County, formalized partnership, working together. We're one of only four such projects awarded this nationwide, and we work closely with other grantees in meetings and conference calls as well. So the goals for this, first of all, is to develop and implement a delivery model that can be integrated more closely into Head Start services. So what I just told you about was great, we think, but for scientific reasons, you know, it was not something that would be really easy to incorporate into existing Head Start and other preschool services. And so we want something that is also sustainable and that can be replicated by other programs. And then we improved our assessments as well. So basically now, not only the kids get to wear the fun cap, but their parents get to wear the fun cap as well, and everybody puts on some electrodes on the chest that allow us to measure heart rate variability, which gives you a very sensitive measure of stress physiology, sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system function. So scientifically super exciting, and allows us to test more rigorously some of these hypotheses with regard to reducing stress in the family. So the first thing we realized is that we needed to change the name and do a little marketing. adventures in marketing with neuroscientists. That was kind of fun. But we've done a cultural adaptation and translation into Spanish to serve Latino families, and we actually stole the name from that. So this program is called Creating Connections: Strong Families, Strong Brains, and again, developed a compelling logo. And what we've done now is we put this brain train, attention training component into the classroom. So it's integrated throughout the school year. Mm. And then something we're really excited about, in addition to that, is we're having the teachers use some of these same strategies that we're teaching the parents. So integrating some of these selective parenting strategies. And then we still maintain the 8 weeks of parent groups, group meetings. And what's exciting about that is we have some wonderful Head Start folks who are now transitioning, and this year actually is the first year leading these parent groups as interventionists themselves. It's really wonderful. So we offer different days and times to try to make it as easy as possible for folks to make it to these groups. As I mentioned, something we're really excited about scientifically is that, you know, we're now integrating these selective parenting strategies into the classroom. The goal here is to really increase the consistency from the classroom to the home environment. So we have teachers using the same vocabulary that we're going to be working with the parents to incorporate into the home environment, specific praise, clear statements, vocabulary about thinking and using your brain, and then some of the same strategies that we use with parents to increase consistency in the relationship between caregiver and child. And the idea is that this greater consistency will lead to even greater reductions in stress for children. It'll allow children to be more familiar with these strategies before we start talking to the parents, and so hopefully enable the parents to have more success with these strategies, and then also help us get more parents to come to the parent groups, which I admit is the bane of my existence. It's very challenging. And so just a quick favorite that the teachers really love, and the parents really love this too, any of our meetings with parents in any of our classrooms, you'll see lots of post-it notes. We use picture notes as a way for teachers and parents to communicate effectively with children, and then integrate that into weekly calendars that are similar to what we call success charts at home. The idea is reducing stress with increasing predictability and consistency, more routines that you can build up over time. That's effective in many ways. It also allows you to do more delay of gratification. So I want ice cream instead of no. Oh, well, ice cream's not an option right now, but let's sit down together, let's draw an ice cream cone, and let's find where on the schedule ice cream is an option. So delay of gratification, which is good for these systems as well.
Lieutenant Malmstrom, did you have a question?
Yes, I did.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Back 22 slides ago on 47, I would like, if you can bear with me, I had a few questions about some of these foundational interventional studies. The Beccadarian Project, for example, it's listed here, $42,871 average cost per child. Was that per year or for the five-year studies, my first question?
I will admit that I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
Okay, and then second question, is that in those 1970s dollars, or is that projected today? And third one, which I really hope you have an answer for, is going down these, I'm real familiar with these projects. Mm-hmm. There was, Dr. David Olds did a very famous longitudinal study. Are you familiar with the Nurse Family Partners Project and his work? And it went out the long longitudinal. I'm surprised you didn't quote any of that. Did you feel that was repetitive or what?
I didn't mention that only in the interest of time, and I actually have a slide at the end that does mention the Nurse Family Partnership, because that is a very important program.
Right.
Only in the interest of time.
Okay.
That's a very important point.
Thank you.
And I have some slides at the end that speak to cost and benefit cost, and so perhaps...
Right, that was the other time with that, why I was asking about the money. So.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. I'll go quickly and make sure I get to that. Okay. If you're interested in seeing what this actually looks like, we were lucky enough to be featured on a really interesting documentary film that aired last September on PBS Nova called School of the Future. We're in the first half hour. It's very interesting. They're featuring work with researchers and educators working together on a variety of different issues. And they did a really nice job of capturing this two-generation concept, both in the home, in the classroom, and in the parent groups. And it's a very interesting film. So we're testing these hypotheses that, that targeting self-regulation simultaneously can improve stress physiology in both children and parents. And we're also looking at questions about broader effects concerning family well-being. So we've improved our assessments. As I mentioned earlier, we're now assessing stress physiology and brain function in both children and parents, so that should give us a more rigorous set of results. And then we're also looking at broader outcomes related to family well-being, including health, education, financial decision-making. There's some really interesting discussions in the literature, including some really interesting work by Phil Fisher, discussing the promise of targeting self-regulation with these two-generation approaches, of course with the goal of protecting children from the consequences of early adversity and providing foundations for school readiness, but also that they might have these other effects in improving self-regulation in adults that might lead to broader improvements. And so we're trying to provide some evidence on that. So this is the idea of self-regulation in adulthood is also a core capability important for success in both the home and the workplace. And so we'll have some evidence speaking to that as well. Finally, hopefully speaking to your point, Representative Malmstrom, the cost to society and the benefit cost relative of these programs. So first of all, some recent studies of the effects of poverty estimate the cost to be equivalent to almost 4% of GDP, about $500 billion a year. That is in reduced productivity and economic output, increased crime costs, and both indirect and direct health expenditures, including in this particular study, they included estimates of life expectancy and decreased life expectancy associated with poverty. Really interesting recent study looked at this in a different way. They looked in a study, a very famous study in New Zealand, Dunedin study in New Zealand. They have a wealth of longitudinal data. And what they did was they looked at the most vulnerable 22% of this cohort, for which they had a wide range of longitudinal data, based on early risk factors, socioeconomic status, exposure to maltreatment, IQ, and self-regulation. And then what they wanted to do was they wanted to say, what percentage of this cohort, what percentage of the health and social economic burden outcomes is this percentage of the cohort, this relatively small percentage of the cohort, responsible for? Any guesses? 22%, the most 22%?
96.
96. That is actually close on some measures. So depends on the measure. These are measures of social welfare, fatherless children, some health measures, and crime. So not quite 96%, but up there on some of these, 78%, 81%, for example. Now, when you look at the 30% who are the least vulnerable in terms of these risk factors, it's a very different situation. So underscoring the cost to society. And then finally, again, these longer-term studies, including the nurse-family partnership, Abecedarian and Perry Preschool, provide evidence that inform work of economists. And we're fortunate to have worked with, we work with Dr. James Heckman, whose work is pretty well known at the University of Chicago. We're part of his early childhood working group. So he and others have done pretty rigorous cost-benefit analyses of these programs. And basically, anywhere from 4-1 up to 9-1. And what I like about Heckman's work is that he recently published a study that was addressing many, this goes beyond my knowledge specifically, but many concerns from conservative economists on some of his earlier work, and still came out with about a 7-1 return on investment. We work with economists as well at the University of Oregon. A very early estimate based on some of this work came out at about 9-1. We're currently conducting an updated benefit cost analysis working with Professor Bill Harbaugh. So again, the developing brain is very plastic. Engaging parents and home environment can strengthen preschool, and high-quality early education is a good investment. This is just a free video that we made. If you're interested in learning more about the effects of early experience on brain development, it's all free online at changingbrains.org, available soon in Spanish. And I have to make sure to just thank especially our wonderful friends at Head Start Lane County, and I just want to point out, I'm just lucky enough to talk to you about this, but we have a whole host of amazing, wonderful folks down in Eugene who make this possible. So thank you for your time. It's been an honor.
A question about your current research.
Yeah.
So what phase are we in? How long is that?
You've actually been doing
that? Yeah, it's a five-year project, and we're currently in year four, so we're finishing up what will probably be the last year of laboratory data acquisition, and we're finally reaching the point where we'll have the statistical power to start looking at some of these questions, so we're pretty excited. And then next year is the last year, and we're focusing on analyzing and writing up the results, and then also on sustainability.
Yeah.
So we're actually looking for some outside funding from foundations to really help us finalize the manualization and training protocols and help Head Start of Lane County sustain this beyond the grant. So.
Great. Thank you very much. And obviously reinforces all we're talking about, the early investments and the tension, what the return is. That's great. That's great information. Thank you so much for coming and doing that. Anything further?
This was great.
It was
great. Thank you.
Let's close the informational hearing.
Thank you.
Let's close the informational hearing.
Thank you. Okay.